All righty. Good morning, Coastsiders. It's Friday, December 30th, 2022. Time for some coastal windage. And when I say coastal windage, I mean a special edition of coastal windage. I am, in fact, Ruben Truthmaker, and this is Coastal Windage, the talk of the Coastside's very own live call-in talk radio show. Listeners will know this, and if you're not a listener, then you won't hear this, but we air every Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. right here on KHMB Radio 100.9 FM and Rockin' 1710 a.m. and anywhere in the world with an internet connection on khmbradio.com. All right, this is an opportunity to hear about and discuss local issues with other local people and a chance to add your 2 cents worth, so pay up and pitch in. Okay. Today's topics, there's only one topic today. I know we do a multitude of topics every week, but this is a special show. This is a one-hour, special one-hour Shooting the Breeze live interview with comedian, writer, producer, and social activist W. Kamau Bell and Tom Sawyer, manager and owner of the legendary Cobbs Comedy Club in San Francisco for about 20 years, from 87 to about 2005.
29.
29 years, okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
That was, again, in my mind, a comedy legend because of the movie that you'll be featured in tonight, The Comedy Show, Comedy Club. Okay, both of these guys are featured in tonight's first screening at the Beach Break Film Festival, The Comedy Club, which is a documentary about Cobbs Comedy Club in San Francisco and its importance to the development of comedians and the business of comedy in the 80s, 90s, and aughts. Doors open at the film festival at 3:30 for this movie. The movie starts at 4, and after the screening, these two will be part of a question and answer session with the filmmakers and some dude named Ruben Truthmaker. Okay. Normally, our Shooting the Breeze segments are short, live interviews with interesting and notable Coastsiders. But with both of you here in town, we couldn't pass up the chance to get your thoughts on the movie, the festival, the Coastside, and beyond. And that's where we'll get into some real fun, some unvetted questions. Okay. All right. Listen to Coastal Windage right now on the internet. Go to khmbradio.com, click the Listen Live link. All right, pay some bills right here. Cameron's Pub and Restaurant is the sponsor of our show. That is the English pub at the south end of Main Street. I think everybody who's lived on the Coastside for more than a day knows about Cameron's. But let me just remind you, it's an authentic English pub with lots of beers, great grub, pub grub, fish and chips, homemade clam chowder, free Wi-Fi, right? That's kind of a selling point these days, right? You got to have the free Wi-Fi. Outdoor doggy dining patio. Say that fast 3 times. And as I mentioned last week, they got something going there every night. They've got open mic. They've got Trivia Tuesday. They got a game room, a gift shop. Check out Cameron's while you're in town, guys. Check that out. It's kind of a Coastside tradition. All right. If you want to... Already we've got a couple. I was going to say, if you want to call in, here's the number. But hey, that's Cameron, right? Exactly.
It's my wife.
Where are you?
She found you.
Yeah. Okay, this is Ruben, Tom, and Kamau. Who have we got on the phone with us this morning?
No, this is Michael Houlihan. I am the executive producer.
Right. Michael, you're going to be part of the question and answer session later this evening, right?
I guess. I am going to be, yes, I believe so.
That's a yes? Okay, great. Michael, what are your thoughts here on the movie and the film festival so far?
Well, I think the film festival is a fantastic asset to your community, and I congratulate Julie Bell and all her friends for making this happen. It's a great way to bring some culture into a small community. And as far as our film, and by the way, we went yesterday and saw some of the films, and they were fantastic. We watched Buried, which was really an eye-opener. I highly recommend it. The movie that we were the executive producers on is called The Comedy Store.
And Comedy Club.
Yeah.
Michael, somebody's getting fired over here. It's that intern right over there. That intern right there.
You know, and maybe you should talk to Bonnie. I think probably. No, anyway. So the Comedy Club is really is story of entrepreneurship. These are the people in this world who take chances on dreams. And sometimes those dreams pan out, and sometimes they pan out for a while, and then they fail, and sometimes they pan out and become wildly successful. So Bonnie and I appreciate that because we are the founders of Barefoot Wine, which has became the world's largest wine brand. And believe me, we've had to face bankruptcy almost every day. So when I was intrigued by the story of Tom and, you know, just the guts that it took for him to do what he did. And then to create a platform for this incredible media of comedy, especially stand-up comedy, I was like blown away. I thought, this is really great. And, you know, I was born and raised in San Francisco. My father was a cop in the Mission District. And so this is something San Francisco really gave the world, which is, you know, the pioneering of stand-up comedy. And so we were very, very honored to be asked to help finance this artistic expression of entrepreneurship and all these great comics. I mean, you take a look at all the people who pioneered at this club, and I myself was... I was in my 20s, so I'm an old man now, of course. But I was in my 20s, and I went down to what is called Cobb's Comedy Corner on Chestnut Street, you know, and sat at the bar, and some guy would get up on this little stage, was about 4 feet, you know, across, and just stand up and start telling jokes. And I thought, this is an interesting club, you know. And I mean, and it was great. I mean, Paula Poundstone and... you know, all the great people. I mean, and the other thing that's interesting about this movie is it shows how the comics really identified with this dream that Tom had to the degree that they were willing to come down and give their own labor to help rebuild the club. You know, I mean, that's just an amazing statement right there.
I know, Michael, I was just thinking, like, there's a scene in the movie where Kamau, and I can't remember if he's hanging drywall or like sweeping out the room or something, but he kind of walks past and says something to the camera like, yeah, Tom's got me doing this now. Like, and I was thinking like, wait a minute, like these like world famous, you know, entertainers are like sweeping the floor and hanging drywall. But
I wasn't, so, not at the time. I wasn't world famous at the time.
Right. Yeah. That's what I forgot is that, oh, now they're world famous, yeah. Right? But this is a time when they were the incubator for their success.
I'd still help out now. I'll help. If Tom needs to move now, I'll help him move. I mean, I'll call somebody to help him move.
Yeah, exactly, right?
I'll give him some recommendations of people who can help him.
What I love about it is that the comedians were a team with Tom. And, you know, they shouldered in there. They all knew that this was their opportunity, so they all had a stake in it. So the comedians are kind of like entrepreneurs themselves, right? So they're betting on their own future, and they're looking for strategic allies to work with, and Tom is that guy. And I mean, you know, for whatever other issues there may be, the fact is it was their gate. And, you know, it obviously was a good bet on all their parts, because look where they are now. And I know, having had a career for 30 years myself, you've got to have a break. You've got to get started. Somebody's got to notice you. You know, you've got to make that first sale. So, yeah, that was very cool. And I love all those comics, of course. And, you know, I later moved over to Berkeley. So I know, Kamau, you've got some roots over there.
Yes. I've been kicked out of some of the finer coffee shops in Berkeley.
I know you have. You're world famous for being kicked out of places.
All right. Okay, well, Michael, thank you for the call this morning. And I will be joining you on stage with these gentlemen later this evening. And we're really going to, like, dive into that, because I want to get to these guys this morning, but I want to talk to you more about your orientation to this movie as an entrepreneurial story, I'm putting air quotes because I'm sitting next to two legends here, but as a creative, I see it as a creative story and a hero story in terms of Tom, and, like, yes, the dream and the talent that he had to recognize talent and to bring those disparate personalities together in a formula that was electric. It was the story to me, and so it. But behind that, and as I mentioned in the intro, there was the business of comedy and how it changed over the years. And to me, that is a tragic part of the hero story for me, of like how the business changed. But I would love to explore all of these elements with you tonight in front of a sellout crowd. So be ready, because I'm really I'm just so excited to talk to you about this movie tonight, Michael.
Okay, we're going to have a blast. And, best to Tom and Kamal. And thank you guys for, all of your contributions to give us the comedy that we have today. It's fantastic.
Definitely. All right. Thank you, Michael. Talk to you tonight.
All right. Guys. Bye, guys. Bye.
Okay.
So that's how it works. The executive producer doesn't have to show up. Is that how that works?
I was going to ask you, are you guys morning people or night owls?
I mean,
comics are generally morning people.
No.
Are they? No. What?
I'm only a morning person.
There's going to be some sarcasm on this show. You're going to have to.
I'm not familiar with that.
I have a legal responsibility to three small people, so I have to be a morning person.
Yeah, I don't. I have a record collection.
Yeah. Excellent.
Those are your babies. I'm famously not a morning person, so I appreciate you joining me at what I call the crack of dawn here.
Yeah.
Like other people are like, I've been up since 5:30. When did getting up, or why is getting up early some sign of virtue? Like, I never understood that. Like, okay, so I stay up later, you get up earlier, what's the difference?
Yeah, right? I would be going to bed sometimes when people would be jogging on the street.
Yes,
and
thank
I would
you.
Be like, I just drive by my car, go give him the finger.
Thank you.
Yeah.
If you're up
thank
at five,
you, healthy guy.
Yeah. If you're up at 5:30 jogging, here's my car. Here's the front end of my car.
I have to get back into my coffin.
Well, Julie is also a night owl, so okay, great. We're all of like mind here, wiping a little sleep out of the eye, pounding the coffee. Let me do the air quality report, and then we're going to get right into it. I'm really stoked here. Okay, right. So air quality report. I'm sure you guys have been on a number of radio shows and radio programs. Nowhere else do you get the actual data on the air quality around you. You might get a spare the air day notice, but we go right into the data here, right? So let's remember the scale 0 to 50 is incredible. It's like breathing pure oxygen. 51 to 100, better. I mean, good, but not as good. Over 100, not so good. Today in El Granada, 8. Today here in Half Moon Bay, 5. 1. In Redwood City across the hill, that's literally like breathing pure O2. 3 in Santa Cruz, and in the Mattapan neighborhood of Boston, Massachusetts, 81 today.
That sounds
about right.
That tracks.
Yeah, okay.
Black right. neighborhood, that's how it works.
Maybe we should burn less tires.
Yeah.
Mattapan, the capital of burning tires.
Oh, is it really? I have not been to
the south part of Boston.
Yeah.
that's funny.
Southie. Hey, Belt, stop with the burning of the tires. I'm coughing over here.
Nice. All right, non-standard show today. Not substandard, listeners. Don't hear that. Non-standard. Last week I gave them all the day off last
Very
week.
Nice.
It was the first time I was alone in this room since COVID. But this week, our studio is packed with people, all the interns, Frank the engineer and his assistants, two producers, the advertising manager, our two special guests and their entourages. See, this is why we did some renovation of this lovely studio a while back. And that's why I asked for the elevated viewing gallery, because we always have so many people in here.
Yeah.
It gets crowded, right?
Yeah.
So we have room to really stretch out.
Multiple skylights. There's a domed roof. It's really nice in here.
Okay, see? People thought I was just making this up.
No. Absolutely not.
I mean, if Kamau says it's true, then it's true.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah,
okay, that's what you tell your kids.
There's even room up for my guy, Bill, over here, who's the guy who dials my phone for me.
Oh, now I see the long, slender fingers. Yeah.
Yeah, and I tell him he's on it.
Okay, well maybe we need to order a pizza just to see him at work.
He could do that. Don't say it out loud because he'll do it. He's chomping at the bit to dial a number.
Nice. Okay, so the Coastside has been given a real gift this holiday season by Coastsider Julie Mell and her team, the Beach Break Film Festival. It's been running this week. Tonight is the last night of the film festival, and I mean, there's a reason that this movie is on the last night, in my opinion, because it's local, San Francisco scene, and I'm not sure that it has gotten much play in other places. And I heard something about it was lost in a file somewhere for like 15 years.
No.
No? Okay. Well, hey, we're trying to build a buzz here, right?
Yeah, one of the good things to come out of COVID is people needing content.
Yes.
You know? So, and then people realize it was good, you know? There's a lot of stuff behind the scenes that a lot of people don't know is... Because I think at one point Judd Apatow was thinking about getting involved with it and producing it, but he had too much on his plate, which is, you know, which is
that's how he rolls.
That's how he rolls.
That's the name of his production company: Too Much on My Plate Productions.
Well, speaking of too much on your plate, I mean, come out everywhere doing everything. You got United Shades of America. What, fifth season? Sixth season?
Seventh season. It's all right.
Yeah, okay, this one right over here now. I mean,
we're firing people right and left.
I mean,
it's
okay.
There's short seasons. It's CNN. Nobody's paying attention, but it's seventh season.
Seven seasons. It's amazing. Okay, this intern's news right here. Three Emmys?
Yes, three Emmys.
Three Emmys.
Yeah. An Emmy for each child, as we think about it at my house.
Nice. Yeah. Okay, so you're working on a fourth child.
Nope.
Emmy, I mean.
if I need to have another kid to win an Emmy, I'm done winning Emmys.
Well, I don't think you're done winning Emmys, but three Emmys. And author, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, Do the Work, an anti-racist workbook. Stand-up comic, obviously. We just watched your Netflix comedy special, which was obviously hilarious. ACLU ambassador. I just saw that commercial randomly on the TV. I went, hey, wait.
I know that guy. One of my friend's moms is like, now come out with $20 a month. Hey, that's how I do it. I need $20.
And dad and husband. Okay?
Yep.
Okay, so which of these projects are you most proud of?
I mean, husband. I can't believe I've kept that going for we've been together almost 20 years next year. So that's the long-term project that takes the most work.
Congratulations.
And it's not her fault. It's my fault.
Congratulations on that. Tom, was it 2005? You will see this in the film, at the end of the film, that you owned and managed Cobbs for up until 2005?
Almost 29 years.
Yeah, actually, well, the brief history is booked Cobbs from 82 to 87 and then owned Cobbs from 82 to 88 and then owned Cobbs from 87 to 2005. So owned Cobbs from
1987 to 2004,
yeah,
2005.
Yeah, and then worked for Live Nation booking Cobbs for another 7 years.
Mm-hmm. So you sold to Live Nation, but you stayed on as a booker?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a smart move by Live Nation because, again, like one of the things that comes out of the movie, for me, in my mind, is that you're a comedy whisperer in the sense of something, and let's just get right into that. Was this a moment in time specific to the locale of San Francisco, to the moment in time of history pre-social media, pre-streaming platforms that can never happen again?
Well, honestly, I think most things could never happen again. So so there's an evolution, and usually we end up taking a step or two backwards, but then we're still moving forward because we took five steps forward. So yeah, there's a different shift in what comedy was like because the 80s we had all kinds. It was like a perfect storm of talent that began with Robin Williams getting national attention, bringing national attention to San Francisco, Alex Bennett being the hub of comedy radio, just as much so at the time as Howard Stern, and also that a guy like me was coming into a scene who is actually a comedian who started booking comedy and started because I loved comedy and I wanted to book comics that I really loved. So as opposed to trying to make money, I was trying to entertain an audience. And to do so, I needed who I thought were the best comics in the country at the time. But, you know, what changed was going from, you know, from 110-seat room to 200-seat room to 400-seat room. And when I hit the 400-seat room, then it became a business.
Right.
And that's when, well, I'm kind of obsessed with being, like, the best you know, at what I do. It's also when you realize you no longer can book good shows, you have to book popular shows. And there's a distinct difference between the two. There are people that I think we were talking about this last night, like, you know, Tracy Morgan or Jamie Kennedy or I can name names now because I don't care.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, wow, we're going. Yeah.
Angela Johnson.
Technically, I was listening. Just kidding.
Yeah. For me, they're people who don't make me laugh. And I would never have booked them probably at my club in the Cannery because I didn't need to. Mm-hmm. I was sold out most of the time anyways with the comics that I had. And I had an audience that absolutely trusted who I booked, and they would come to the club regardless of who the headliner was or not. So the difference with this room was I needed comics who put asses in the seats.
Yeah. I mean, as a comic who was up and coming at the time, I came into the scene when what I call the old Cobs, what other people called the new Cobs, because there had been a Cobs before that, but the Cobs in the Cannery, it was like, what, 125 seats or something? Or 100?
No, that was about 200.
200, okay, 200 seats, which is like, in a comedy club, this is a really small, intimate room. And so, and it was also, it's in the tourist district, so there are people who are just like, I want to see comedy. And so you sort of like, there was always an audience there, and we as comics always thought of, because there's Cobs on one side of town and the Punch on the other side. Yep. And even though they were similarly sized, the booking strategy was quite different. So you would get like, so Tom, we always felt like that was like a boutique. Like that club was like, he, if it makes him laugh, he books it. If he doesn't make it laugh, he doesn't book it. It's made many comics crazy because they're like, but I'm popular and people think I'm funny. And he's like, I don't care. I'm sure there are people who still wake up with Tom Sawyer nightmares. Like, cause it was like, why can I play that club, but I can play this club? And the Punchline, which was a good club too, but just because it was connected to, at that point, Bill Graham Presents, there was always a sense of like, the up-and-coming comics that were coming from L.A. would often, who weren't famous yet, but they were courting a relationship with and blah, blah, blah. So they would get headlining spots at the Punchline, and we'd be like, who is this person? And then those people would become people many times. So it was like there was a very different strategy. Both great clubs. I spent a lot of time playing both clubs. But Cobbs is always like, you want to kill with the audience, but there's a sense that you're playing for Tom. Like, you know, that like if Tom likes you, you might be able to bomb a little more often. But you could be killing and Tom could not care less if he didn't like your act.
That's an interesting point you make come out, because in seeing the movie, like, not only playing for Tom, but for the other comedians that were maybe backstage in the green room. I don't want to give away all of the movie because people are going to go see it and then we're going to talk about it tonight, but the whole camaraderie and I just call it the incubator. It just seemed like that green room was an incubator based on what I saw in the movie. Obviously, I wasn't there. Kamau, mm-hmm. You were there. Tom, you were there. But the riffing, the notes, the just like joking around, the hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like people would come and just hang out even if they weren't doing a set or they weren't scheduled for a set.
For sure, you would go down there. Like, and also it was about of like, especially when you're starting comedy, you want to hang out at the club because you want to meet people. You want to see. Also, you go, I can see comedy for free. Like, it was like, as a comic, one of the big first wins is that you're allowed to walk into the club at any time and just sit in the back if it's not sold out and just hang out. And if you're friendly to the wait staff and the people who work there, they will let you stand in the back if you still stay out of their way. Then it becomes like, it's a big part of your social scene, and it's a big part of your stewing in like what stand-up comedy is. And you know, and once you are known, it doesn't matter how famous the comic is, if they know you're a comic, you suddenly can be in conversations with anybody. We talked about that last night with Robin Williams would come around, and he would talk to the most basic open micer and also the other known comedians in town. He didn't care because we were all comics.
I mean, the progression up the ladder, let's say, from a person interested in comedy who gets to come in and sit there to a headliner with a Netflix special and other things, that progression, I just wonder how it is today, because in seeing the movie, again, Kamau, you're featured in this. You have a point where you talk about how, like, okay, the progression where you come in and, like, maybe you get to MC for a while. And then
I haven't seen the movie, so I'm excited to see the stuff tonight.
Okay,
that's fine. I'm just like, what did I say?
Yeah. Oh yeah, you said it was brilliant.
Yeah, it's good.
Where you said like you get to MC a few times, and like if you can impress Tom, then maybe you'll get an actual like assigned set. And mm-hmm. So these are things that when you go and see somebody now, and I showed you my ticket stub collection. Listeners know I love ticket stubs. I saw you at the Punchline, and I went and saw Michelle Wolf at the New Cobs. And it's hard to imagine that that progression in the sense that it's shown in the movie, because when you go to the new Cobbs, it's a big room, and I feel like the intimacy is not what I'm seeing in the movie. And I'm sorry to keep referencing it, Kamau. You'll see it tonight. You can just feel that closeness. And when you're talking about Robin Williams, to go up to open mic or walk around the room or whatever, I can envision that in my fantasy, but it's hard to imagine it in today's world with security and the amount of money that the high end people make. Like, it seems like another time.
Yeah. Well, it is another time, because everything is about the bottom line now. And if you're corporate America, there's a guy whose job is it to say he's a he celebrates the nickels and dimes that he saved the company. I wasn't let go from Live Nation because I was doing a bad job. I was letting go because they could probably save themselves like $7,000 or $8,000 a year not having me there. So, giving their other booker a raise and having her get an assistant, they're still saving $7,000 or $8,000. In the meantime, you lose the guy who knows more about comedy than the guy who is head of the all of Live Nation comedy. And no offense, Jeff.
Especially not for me.
You know more about concerts. Jeff's the king of concerts.
I'll say this as a comic, being in San Francisco back in the day, it was a little bit like DC and Marvel. Like, you, there was a sense of, like, some people chose one and didn't choose the other. And then there were people like me who were like, I'm Spider-Man. Sometimes I end up in a DC comic book. I don't care. You know what I mean? Like, there's a sense of, like, there really was, like, it really felt like you were allowed to work both clubs, of course, but there were comics who chose one over the other for various reasons.
And maybe one of the reasons was Tom.
Oh, yeah. Either for the good or the bad. Either he's my guy or he's definitely not my guy. But
All right, so let me give some background to listeners, because I've seen the movie a couple times now. So Michael said it's called The Comedy Store.
No.
Comedy Club.
Yeah, no.
Comedy Club, right. All right, this is the story of Cobb's Comedy Club. In my mind, a seminal part of the 1980s and 90s and early aughts comedy development in this country. And it documents those times and your struggles and successes over those years, including the fire and the rebuild after the fire at the Battery Street location in 2002, I think it was. And in this movie are some of the most famous comedians that people recognize today, including W. Kamau Bell. Tom, can you for our listeners, can you list some of the other people that came across that stage? Because people are like, oh, okay, right, you're name dropping Robin Williams and Kamau's there, and that's why you're mentioning him. But no, these are like everybody that you've ever heard of.
I don't make the list of top 100 comics to go through Cobbs. Like, I don't make the, like, I, you know.
It'd be easier to name the comics who didn't play Cobbs.
Exactly.
We were talking about a story of one comic confronted me at the Comedy Day Festival in San Francisco and saying, you know, you never booked me, and, you know, you ruined my career. And, like, I'm like, dude, I got one club in the entire country. I'm sorry if I had that much power over you.
You're like, well, thank you. Yes, yeah, I was that.
I am your lord.
I had a style that I liked. I wanted my audience to feel safe to come to any show, regardless of, you know, on any night, and feel like they were going to be entertained. That was my whole goal.
I want you to name some famous people, though.
Oh, that's thank you.
That's what I'm here
Jim
for.
Carrey played the club for about, like, 5 years, like, did about a month's worth of shows a year.
And we're talking about Jim Carrey, like old, like young Jim Carrey.
Yeah. In that vampire movie. Remember, he was in that vampire movie?
We're talking
80s.
About that. We're closer to that era than current.
Yeah, Earth Girls.
Earth Girls Are Easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was, he would do two-week runs a year. And
so 2 weeks in a row, which is very rare for comics to do.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody does it now.
Patton Oswalt, Brian Regan, Russell Brand,
can I help?
Martin Mull and did Martin Mull? Yeah.
Oh, you go. You go.
And Fred Willard did a Fernwood Tonight reunion at Cobbs.
Mark Maron, maybe you've heard of Mark
yeah,
Maron.
Joe Rogan, you might
Joe
heard
Rogan.
Of him.
Joe Rogan, when he was trying to convince people he was a comedian again after News Radio went up.
Yeah.
Pre-Fear Factor, so old school Joe Rogan, pre-podcast.
When he had hair. Joe Rogan.
And a normal body.
Yeah, normal body.
And better politics. Who else? We can keep going.
Jeannie Garofalo.
Jeannie Garofalo, certainly.
I'm forgetting.
Oh, wait, but
Larry Miller, the old school guys. Jerry Seinfeld played Cobbs.
He was a local guy to the scene, and I didn't know.
D.L. Hughley played Cobbs. D.L. Hughley.
Voice of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Tom Kenny.
Tom Kenny played Cobbs back
then. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tom's actually the one who. I'm actually a voice actor now, and Tom Kenny's the one who said. You know, I was talking to him about, we were just talking. I said, I don't know what I'd do now. And he goes, man, you do a bunch of voices and impressions and stuff. You should get into voiceover. So that's actually what I'm doing now. I have an agent in L.A. and San Francisco. And
like commercials or like animated films? And
Whatever. I audition for everything.
Nice.
That's what my agents want me to do. Well, but I do like animation and video game stuff better because I like character stuff better.
Well, we heard your South Boston character earlier in the show.
That's the thing about you learn about... voiceover is bad impressions turn into great characters. So that was kind of a bad Bill Burr.
It's fun. Nice. All right. We got a phone call here. Let's see who we've got. This is Ruben with Kamau and Tom Sawyer. Who have we got on the phone this morning?
It's Penny Packer.
Okay. Penny Packer, Kamau, and Tom. This is one of our longtime listeners, frequent callers.
Oh, yeah.
So this is kind of
Misty for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got that with the husky voice, right?
Yeah. Okay, we're just riffing on old movies now. Okay, Penny Packer, what's up?
Well, I'm excited to go to the film festival tonight and see the film.
Great, you're going
to
be there,
and to listen to the panel. Mm. But I had a question for Kamau, if that was possible.
Kamau, are you available for questions?
I will answer if it's possible after I hear the question.
Right.
I reserve the right to not answer.
His agent is standing ready to kill the mic.
It's possible to ask a question. We'll see what the answer is.
Want to say hi to your son?
Yeah.
All right, Penny Packer, go for it. We'll see if you get through.
Okay, well, so you were just naming a whole bunch of famous comics that had performed at the comedy club. But I read in the news lately, and I know, Kamau, you did a special on Bill Cosby that he is supposed to be touring next year, and I want to know your thoughts on the ethics of places that decide to host him and the types of people that would go and see him.
Wow. Such a serious question. Yikes. Okay.
I've become one of the America's preeminent Bill Cosby authorities.
I guess right?
Four-part docuseries.
The arbiter of Cosby.
No, because you're a comic.
No, I know.
I'm a famous comic, and I just, figured I'd try to ask you a question you've never been asked before.
Well, that's thank you. I appreciate that. Bill Cosby... I would be shocked if Bill Cosby actually went out on tour next year, just because I think there is the venues that would have to choose to book him would have to deal with whatever community pushback there was.
Yeah.
I did make a film about Bill Cosby, a 4-part series for Showtime. I think that actually, because of the voices in that film, a lot of the conversation around Bill Cosby has shifted pretty dramatically. I'm not saying it was me, I'm saying it was the voices in the film. So I would be shocked that a venue would want to deal with that. Also, Bill Cosby still got legal cases against him. So I don't know that any lawyer worth their lawyering would say, go on tour, do press.
Beyond the public.
So I understand that he said that, but I would be shocked if it actually came to fruition, just because there's a lot of you don't want to be on tour and have legal cases against you. Now, I think that the history of stand-up comedy is, this is separate from Bill Cosby, is the history of a lot of reprobates, a lot of people who operate outside of the social contract. And so I'm not shocked that that happens, because I know the history of stand-up comedy. It doesn't mean it's not all of us, it's not most of us, but it is sort of an Old West mentality in stand-up comedy. And so I think that, I think the thing that it mostly comes out of this is, I think 2022 has proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that cancel culture is not real. That everybody can make a comeback somewhere, and that if you wait, and the only guy who I know who's been canceled for sure is Harvey Weinstein, but if he was not in jail, I'm sure he'd be making movies right now.
Yeah,
I mean it wouldn't be the same level. It would be like a reboot of Air Bud, but it'd still be he'd still be out there making movies. And
well,
that's my first statement.
I love your show, United Shades of America. Your dancing in the Puerto Rico episode. That's on point.
That's my favorite. That's my kid's favorite episode. That's my kid's favorite segment of anything I've ever done is me dancing in that Puerto Rico episode. So
yeah.
Thank you.
All right, Penny Packer.
Thank you so much. Looking great, forward to tonight.
Thank you for calling. Great question. Appreciate the call.
Boom, I nailed that one. I think I pretty good.
That was excellent. And the agent signed. Your agent signed off on that, so that was beautiful. Okay, so...
Tom, did you have anything to add to that?
Well, I was just saying, even like Louis C.K. is making a comeback now. Yeah. So, you know, I think, you know, anytime you do bad things, that's why I don't understand cancel culture because, you know, this didn't come out of left field. There wasn't a bunch of people accusing, and Louis didn't say, hey, I didn't do it. He's saying I did it. Mm-hmm. And I turned out afterwards, I found out that he had propositioned to one of my waitresses at Cobb's. I didn't know about it till later on. She just didn't want to talk about it, you know. And plus, those were the days we would actually hit on the waitresses and tell them that what we wanted to do as opposed to, luring them to the hotel room. Probably because the I'm going to be upfront about what I'm asking you part of it wasn't working out so well because having a ginger guy who's about 40 pounds overweight
what are you saying to me?
It's not appealing to some people, it turns out.
Tell me about it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm going to skip forward to the beyond. Okay, because we were talking the caller. Kind of brings this up, and this was in the comedy special I just watched you discuss. I just went and saw Dave Chappelle and Chris Rock at the Chase Center.
Were you there for Elon Musk night?
We were.
Oh my God!
And so I wanna bring up the topic.
That's called the reverse Oprah, where you get something is given to you that you don't want. You get Elon Musk. You get Elon Musk.
We love Dave, but I think he made a miscalculation there.
We were talking about that last night.
Yeah, he thought it's Silicon Valley. Like I don't know. Man. But the larger topic there, and that both of the comics addressed in the show, but Dave specifically, is the whole idea of the line of like what freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. Okay, and in your Netflix special, you address that, and I wanted to ask you to expand on that even more than you did in the special, because you said like the freedom of speech, absolute. You can say what you want, but then.
It's not freedom from consequences.
Okay, so.
Free speech works not. People say it works both ways. No, it works in all ways. It works. It's like it works in all ways, in all directions, at all times.
So this is what Dave is and people like Bill Maher are saying of like absolute freedom of speech and then deal with the consequences. I wanted to ask you since I had never like really considered that. Okay, there's consequences like being canceled or people protesting,
or people just stop wanting to hang out with you. I mean, it's like we all have that friend that that has said too many things. You're like, I think I have to stop hanging out with that guy. You know what I mean? Like it's very basic. People act like
you canceled your friends.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God, it's so strict.
Stopped hanging out with that guy. You know what I mean? Like I think people get really caught up in the pretend high minded conversation about it when it's like that's how the world has always worked. It's like. Man, I used to hang out with that guy David Duke, but he seems to be like really hitting this white supremacy thing real hard. I don't know. He's not the same guy I used to know. You know what I mean? Like that's the nature of the game is that you can say whatever you want to say, but you have to deal with the consequences. Unless you're super rich, then the consequences don't hit you in the same way. Because the funny thing about Dave Chappelle is that he sort of created a special to get canceled because he knew he couldn't be canceled. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Netflix never stopped payment on the check. They actually took another thing from him after that came out. But the narrative, I mean, that's what cancel culture has become, a branding exercise now. It's like, remember the Hollywood bad boys? Like, wait, isn't it bad to be a bad boy? No, not in Hollywood. And then we found out it's pretty bad. But like, I think it's the same thing with cancel culture. It's become a part of people's brand. They almost want to pre-cancel themselves as a way to say, I didn't get canceled. But in actuality, it's like, no, it's like, you can mess up and people can withdraw from you, but that's not the same thing as this idea of cancel culture. And so, yeah, I think I'm, as a stand-up comic, many stand-up comics say things that I don't agree with, but that's also part of the fun. I think we're sort of also understanding that, like, you can, you know, there are hilarious comedians who say horrible things and I laugh at them. Now, what I don't do is then go tweet them out on Twitter to go, look at this thing, because I don't need other people to know what I laugh at in the privacy of my own home.
Right.
But I think the idea being that, like, but at the same time, if the and also these other things people say, there are many comics touring right now who say horrible things on stage every night, and nobody's trying to cancel them. You know, Anthony Jeselnik is always my favorite example.
He's one of the people I was going to mention.
He's made a whole career off of I'm going to try to think of the worst things I can say and then say them. But because he said that's what I'm doing, nobody's trying to cancel him. Now I think the problem becomes when you're either seen as somebody who is saying things that your audience doesn't agree with, which I think is what's happened to a portion of Dave Chappelle's audience, or you work for a major corporation. I remember Tracy Morgan from back in the day when it's like, you can't necessarily work for NBC and say those things you said. That's not because you know, or if you're Cat Williams, who's never worked for anybody but himself, he can say whatever he wants to say. Right. So I think we really get caught up in this pretend high-minded conversation without understanding that this is the way the world's always worked.
Thank you for that, because it's something that I've been struggling with trying to understand. Hearing you know, Dave, especially at the special or at the comedy show.
Were you in the cheap seats? Was he making fun of you?
No, we were like, we were this far from the steps going up. So when Elon walked by, my wife cursed him out.
I would imagine she probably didn't even do it on purpose. Just sort of came out the way you revolt when you smell rotten eggs.
I gotta tell the story again. Sorry.
Please do.
So we're like right at the steps that go up to this far away, hands reach away. That, you know, Chris and Dave, when they walk by, they're like, Dave, you know. So then he's like, I'm going to bring out a special guest. And we're like looking, you know, down the tunnel, like, because we're just right there. And I'm looking,
plus it's Dave Chappelle. It could be anybody.
I thought it was going to be Steph Curry.
He brought Prince back from the dead. That's Dave Chappelle. It could be anything.
Right. And then I see that it's coming out, and I see that it's Elon Musk. And I go, I just involuntarily went, oh, no. Because my wife hates him. And she's like, what, what? And she starts shrieking, oh, no. I'm gonna attack him. I'm going to hit him. I'm like, no, no, he's the richest man in the world. So he goes up on stage. He does this
silly. I think he's the second richest man in the world because he's got this bad business.
It's because he's a moron. He came on stage. So he's on there being silly. Comes off stage. He's walking by. Here's the thing. He's got his stupid badge that he uses to hanging from the clip. The Silicon Valley like badge that everybody.
Oh my God.
I mean, anyways. So he walks by, he's all strutting by. I wish I had a drink, I'd throw it on him. I'm like, no, no, I don't want to go to jail. He walks by, he's about this far away, and she screams out his name, Elon Musk. He turns around, this big, I'm the richest man in the world smile, and she literally goes, F you, you effing a-hole. And
good for her.
And he just cratered like a 5-year-old that had just been and he like turned around and slugged about
living in a bubble
and like scurried off into the tunnel. And my wife's just like, nah, 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 nah,
nah. I heard it's fun to hurt important people's
feelings. I mean, just the look on his face was worth. So all right, enough about. I've told that story so many times.
You'll be telling that story for the rest of your life.
I think I will.
Yeah, that's a good story. Okay. And also, what's your wife's name?
Jen,
good job, Jen. Yeah. Shout out for hurting Elon Musk's feelings.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that drives me crazy right now, especially because, you know, back in the day, you know, George Carlin, you know, this guy was always punching up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the idea about comedy, you know, was to punch up. You don't punch down. Mm-hmm. And now everybody's just so many, I didn't say everybody, of course, but so many comics that and people that I can't even believe are punching down, and I don't get it. I don't understand it. It just seems to me like it goes against the comedy grain through history. We're talking about like medieval. Everybody was punching up. The court jester would make fun of the king in front of the king's face because that's what he was supposed to do.
He wasn't making fun of the serfs.
Yeah.
King, look at those people over there with their pronouns.
Yeah. And it seems I don't get it. I don't understand.
I mean, I think I can speak as a comedian, it is harder to write jokes from places of empathy. It's easier to write jokes from places of divisiveness. Like, it is easier to write the F you joke than it is to write the I love you joke. It's just the way, that's just the nature of the game. So I think that it becomes easy to sort of like just start swinging at people. And especially once you cross over into that other side of like when you've quote unquote made it, whatever that is for you or whatever. It becomes about keeping power. You know what I mean? What rooms are you in? Who are you talking to regularly? Who are the people that you're around? And what are you taking in? That's like the clearest thing about, like, forget the comedy. Elon Musk is not around regular people. Everybody who's in a room with Elon Musk is being employed by him.
Yes.
In some way. And their job is to keep their job. So they're not going to say the things like your wife would say. If, you know, like if your wife was just in the rooms with him regularly, he might start to understand things differently. If just every time he walked into a room that she was in, she was like, F you, you rah, rah. Hey, maybe I should be more sensitive. You know, like, so I think that's the, it's the nature of the game. It's the thing that, like, why, you know, I don't think, I mean, Tom, please speak to this. People don't get funnier when they get more successful.
No.
Okay, good. I'm glad. I thought it was. Yeah. Richer you get, you don't get funnier.
Well, because you disconnect from regular everyday life. Therefore, you have less to relate to with regular folks. You know, so now you're telling Hollywood stories.
Yeah.
You know, and that goes to, that goes only so far with so many people. And I think that's one of the reasons why you're seeing a lot of punching down now is because the things that Dave Chappelle has to deal with in a day-to-day life, he knows the audience isn't going to relate to. So now it's all about this this energy of outrage and everybody's in outrage mode. Everybody's making money off of being outraged. And they're looking for things to be outraged about. They'll find one thing at one place that's done by four people, and they'll be outraged by it. And that's how they make their living on YouTube or, you know, Patheon or whatever all these places are.
Yeah, it used to be like you had the crazy aunt who would email you the weird story about, there's a thing, kids are pretending to be cats in public schools. You'd be like, oh, crazy aunt, with your crazy stories you send me about all these things. And now that's being reported as news. The crazy aunt stories are being reported as news. And then, and some comedians are picking up those stories and then continuing to report them as, like, these are real things that happened.
I have a friend who did it. Yeah, it's like...
I have a friend. You don't
I have a friend. When somebody says something, when it starts with, I have a friend, mm-hmm. I just tune out right
now. I was like, what's your friend's name? Can we call them? Let's get that.
Is that why you asked me why? What? You're not even married.
I don't believe you're married. Yeah. Jen, really? That's the name you picked out of the blue?
I can't think as fast as you guys.
Mary. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Gertrude.
Gertrude. There we go.
That's a unique name these days, right? Okay. Well, per that, I'm just so happy to have had you guys here because this is a conversation that, like, okay, me and my friends. I do have a couple of actual friends, but. When we're having this conversation, like, we don't know what the heck we're talking about, right? We're not in the business. We don't deal with other people in the business and understand it at this level. Tom, when you were managing the club, was there ever a comic where you just had to pull that person aside and say, no?
Yeah. No. That was a monthly occurrence.
Because they were offensive or just because they weren't good? Because there's a lot.
Well, no, I would never.
If there was something that was just
if
like,
they
dude,
were doing
no.
something that I felt like was not that didn't fit in their act or was against their persona, then yeah, I would say something. I like, dude, don't you should not do that. And you know, basically, tried like the four times I booked Tracy Morgan to do that, dude. Dude, that's not you. You're a funny guy backstage. You're really funny. You know your sense of humor. But outstage, you're trying to be like Martin Lawrence, trying to be all these edgy guys. And it's just coming off as so cringy. So incredibly cringy. If it's not you, and that's the thing I said to comics probably the most of the 29 years I did this, was be yourself because nobody can take that from you. If people are stealing material from you, that's because it's generic material. It doesn't really, it's not really about you. You thought of a funny thing that could happen on an airplane and didn't actually happen to you, and you're doing it on stage, but it's not personal because it's not a personal story. The best comedy comes out of being personal. And that's where I think comics don't understand, even though if you're successful and you've made it, you're still dealing with things that if you do a little deep dive on your daily life, you're still dealing with things that people can relate to, you know?
Well, the authenticity that you're referencing here really comes out in the movie. And again, somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about but is going to say stuff anyways, I feel like that had to have contributed to the success of these people that came through. Like the tutoring of the emphasis on authenticity, and because this movie shows I can feel that room, the authenticity of the room, the stage, the set that you built for that.
I encouraged comics to fail. You know, when I trusted them, when I knew. Look, and we were talking about this last night. Mm-hmm. My thing was like you got a strong act. You know, open strong, close strong, do whatever the hell you want in the middle because that's your time.
And that's not something you hear from. I heard that from one comedy club owner in my career, and it's him. Like, most comedy clubs are like, kill the whole way through, and if you're not killing, I might not book you again. Yeah. Whereas Tom was like, especially during the week, those showcase shows during the week, it would be like, I remember I told him, it changed, it literally changed my career. He was like, it was like the top of the new year. He gathered a bunch of comics together in a circle. He's like, look, I need everybody to start doing new stuff. Stop doing the old stuff. I need you to stop. Every time I ask somebody, why are you doing your old stuff? You say, I'm working on my A stuff. You don't have A stuff. That's why you're here on a Monday. If you had A stuff, you'd be on HBO. He literally said that. I was like, these are some good points he's making. But he's like, open strong, close strong, do new stuff in the middle. And I was like, got it. And that changed my career.
Nice. So we've got a phone call, I think. This is Ruben.
Dave Chappelle.
Or Elon. Elon. Or
Tracy Morgan. Tom's been offending a lot of people. They're all calling in.
Okay, who we got on the phone this morning?
Hi, my name is Rachel.
Hi, Rachel. What's on your mind this morning?
Hi. Great to talk to you both, and so excited to see the film tonight. I had a question about... I know this is a comedy show, and we're going to be laughing throughout this movie, but also there's a lot of touching moments in comedy, and there's a lot of people that you're going to be showcased in this film and that we're going to be watching that aren't with us anymore, or there's powerful moments that happened. Tom, is there a moment in this film that really struck you on an emotional level that we can keep an eye out for as we're watching the movie that was powerful or that maybe was a dedication to someone or something that really spoke to you and told you that this was a movie that you really needed to make and you got like a real sense that this was an important thing to be doing?
I feel like we're on Rachel's show now. That was a real pivot.
That was a
good question.
Good question, Rachel.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It's a weird thing when someone's doing a documentary about you because you have no control over it. Basically, you know, you're saying, you know, put the camera wherever you want, do whatever you want, edit it the way ever, whatever way you want, because I have no control of it. Because people go, well, how come I wasn't in the movie? I have friends. Like, my best friend is not in the film. I have two best friends, Jake Johansson and Rob Becker, both really successful comics, and they're both not in the movie. And they go, why wasn't I in the film? I go, dude, I'm not the director. I didn't direct it. I mean, he asked me, and I gave him a list, and, you know, it's up to him after that. So, but I will say probably the most, you know, there are a number of moments in the film, but a lot of people don't understand that, you know, especially when you're building a club with about $500,000 and being $500,000 in debt, and you're coming out of a 200-seat room to a 400-seat room, and you realize that you've just booked 6 months' worth of shows that mostly are going to fail because you get it now how this room has to work, but you can't – it's like you can't steer the ship. You see the iceberg now, but you're too close to it to steer away. You're going to hit the iceberg. So when it's like that – that was there's a point in the film that's really hard for me to watch is when I was melting down because I knew everything was I knew where we were going and I knew that it was going to be really really a bumpy ride and I never had cold sweats before. I never experienced it, you know, I didn't even understand the concept. I had cold sweats every day for 3 months because every day I thought this could be the day that we go under. And and you know, you have a lot of pressure because, I mean, a lot of people, I think, look up to, you know, the club and what we wanted to do and we're trying to do, and the comics were being there and being helpful, and because they wanted to work too, and everybody was on the same page. And before, I had the same thing happen when we opened the cannery, except it was my, you know, parents had sold their house to, you know, to invest in Cobbs, and for some reason, I was always opening a new club in November, which is like the worst time to open because December is the absolute worst month in comedy, and except for the New Year, except for the week after Christmas, which is great, but everything else is horrible. So every time I had to go through this gauntlet, this rocky sea to get to the other side, to get to February where things are amazing.
Well, I appreciate that call from Rachel because it's called The Comedy Club. It's about the comedy scene, and yet to me this is a poignant movie, okay, because of the emotion that the viewer is going to feel seeing you struggle through that, seeing young comics on the way up and the way they bond, the camaraderie there, feeling that positive energy. But then, as you said, like seeing the iceberg looming up ahead, the filmmakers do an excellent job of like that looming sense that, you know, that something has shifted, that that this ship may be going down, and you're rooting for it to like miss the iceberg. It's a poignant film. Yeah, it's an important historical document as well.
And the other thing I realized too with A New Club, and for me, it was what I really enjoyed most about the club business, was working with young comics, working with people like Kamau. It really was devastating to me when more and more headliners were bringing their acts who aren't good. Most of them, like 95% of them,
names?
Aren't good.
those are the names I want
to
hear.
As we close this hour out, I'd like to say that I did not stand by all of Tom's comments.
But you can pick names out of a hat. I mean, you know, for the most part, I mean, it's shocking to me when somebody is actually really good that a comic brings with them, because they don't want to have to follow a tough act. And that's what comics had to do all the time at Cobbs. It wasn't, you'd go into the room and, you know, if it didn't matter who you were, you know, you had two acts behind you that wanted to be where they were.
Right.
And not only that, but, you know, the bar was so high at Cobbs that, you know, people that were middle acts were headliners at most other clubs. Mm-hmm. And MCs were featured acts. So everybody's trying to get to the head guy's spot. So it was like kind of Game of Thrones every show. You know, there was a...
every show was a red wedding.
Yeah, where every act was going, follow that mofo, you know. And
right.
So, and it made everybody a better comic.
Yeah. I mean, that, again, I mentioned the camaraderie and the riffing and stuff, but there's also that energy of like everybody's in competition with each other, and that just like raised everybody up.
But I think especially at Cobbs, it wasn't a competition where you were mad at the guy. You were just like, can you follow that? Oh, yes,
right,
I can. Like,
exactly.
We were all friends. And also, can you follow that? And here's a tag for your act. I thought of something for your act. So it's like, it's not, that's what I liked about it. It really felt like a playground for comedians. A lot of clubs feel like a killing floor.
that was the first time when we had Jim Carrey at the club. You know, I said, dude, you know, after the first week, and it was the same exact show every night. And I was saying, and I just pulled him aside after the last show that week, because he remember he had a 2 week run. And I said, I really, really want you to think about this place as your gymnasium. I want you to be as creative as you want. I want you to put that set aside. Do it at other places. This is the place where you do the things that you've been thinking about doing it, or you were afraid to do. You weren't quite sure if the audience was going to get it. You know, like you're the guy at the restaurant who is constantly nauseous. That bit. the audience is literally starting to get a little heavy themselves, because he was doing it so realistically, and we were laughing our asses off. But you know, he would do that kind of stuff. I mean, that's where Fire Marshal Bill came from. All that stuff came from him opening the doors to his creativity, because I stress that so much to comics. You are not going to get better doing the same act every night. It's not going to happen. It can't happen.
So we got 1 minute left. I didn't get to any of the fun stuff, the silly stuff. Like, do you have some Trump-like NFTs that you're coming out for United Shades? You know, do you like superhero movies? Okay, but last question on this one, because it may be obvious. Maybe you're just like, dude, I think we've answered that like five times. But can comics? Is there a place for them to do that in today's business?
I mean, let's be clear. Every city has an open mic scene. Every city has, I think there are more sort of like comics now understand. The Generation Comics came up after me, had a more DIY mentality, a more punk rock mentality about it, because the clubs were dying, or they weren't as open to experimentation as Cobbs was. So there are always comics. I just watched a special last night that was taped, that was free on YouTube. A lot of specials going on for free on YouTube. A woman named Alice, and I'm not going to remember her last name, but it was called Sex Criminal, and it was a 28 minute set where she targeted one comedian who she considers to be a sex criminal, and it was like, whoa, 28 minutes,
wow,
astoundingly brave and amazing, and also like sort of rough and not really fully formed, And I don't know where she taped it, but there will always be people who are like, if it's not going to work in the club or I'm not being given that permission, I'm going to take it myself.
Yeah, and that's a great thing about how streaming has opened up things. And I think it's actually made another renaissance in comedy where a lot of clubs are doing good, and they're filling up off nights with people who are like the acts that Kamal was talking about, and they've got this little devoted following that's good enough to put 250 seats on a Tuesday night, and that's great for comedy. Mm-hmm. You know, keep pushing the envelope, you know, and because, hey, look, you know, if you're at the top of the ladder, there's always somebody looking to knock you off. You know, Dave Chappelle isn't going to be Dave Chappelle forever, and there'll be somebody, you know, hopefully braver and smarter, who isn't going to go down the road, you know, he has, and it's going to make a better comedy scene for everybody.
Alice Hamilton, I just Googled her, Alice Hamilton. I don't know why I didn't, and the comedian was Chris D'Elia she was targeting. I don't know why I was trying to be cute about it, but anyway, yeah, Alice Hamilton.
All right, well, that's unfortunately all the time we have for today. I feel like we could talk to you guys for 3 hours because the history of comedy right here, the present and future of comedy right here, right? Thank you so much for coming and visiting our little show and our radio station here in town. Thanks for coming to town. Folks, if you haven't already got a ticket, and I don't know where you can get one at this point because this is the hot show in town tonight, 4 o'clock, the Comedy Club at the Coastal Rep Theater here on Main Street. Be there. These guys are going to be there. We're going to see the show. Then afterwards, there's going to be
a question. And we can swear.
I believe so, right. The FCC is not in the room there. So anything goes, right? And they will be on stage with the producers of the film and myself for a question and answer session. It should be lively and fun. Thank you both so much. Really, really enjoyed it and appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
All right. And that is it for Coastal Windage today. Tune in next week, every Friday at 9 a.m., for more local topics and discussion. That's you, that's me, that's us. Coastal Windage, the talk of the coast.